if you can turn to Nehemiah chapter 7, we'll be in a couple of other places, but obviously that's our main text tonight. We're at the time of year now, isn't it? The sun is shining, and I'm sure plenty of parents here, plenty of grandparents are going to hear the phrase, "Are we nearly there yet?" If you haven't heard it already. But whether you're a parent, whether you're a primary school teacher, or you help out with kids' club here or elsewhere, I'm sure you've heard a child say when they're doing schoolwork, when they're making craft, when they're tidying their room, or when they're eating dinner, when the child says, "Finished." And you walk over, and actually you see only half the maths questions are done, or only one part of the picture is coloured in, or they've only put one thing away in their room and the rest of it's still a mess, or they've had two mouthfuls of their food and that's it. And you're like, well, no, you're not finished. You clearly haven't finished. And I don't know what follows after that, maybe the odd tantrum. But we get to Nehemiah chapter 7 here, and you look down verse 1, and you see the very first word you see is, "Now when the wall had been built." And we might have the same cause as the kids to say as, "Finished." We saw with Ben a couple of weeks ago in chapter 6, we read in verse 15, "So the wall was finished." We read it was finished in 52 days. And that's amazing, isn't it? That was a vast kind of structure. The outlines of the wall of Jerusalem was the same as it was before. So it didn't make it any smaller. It was still a vast building project. And to do that in 52 days is incredible. So there we are. Job done. Finished. Let's put down the tools that perhaps close up our Bibles, put our feet up and look at a wall. And we've been here about, you know, Nehemiah is about rebuilding. Well, it's rebuilt, done and dusted, over, complete, accomplished, finished. And like the child with food still on their plate or schoolwork yet to be completed, the building here, it's not really done. And we're starting chapter 7 here, which means we've got about half the book still to go. Nehemiah doesn't take a break and have a Kit Kat. No, he knows. You see verse 5, there's still work to be done. Verse 5, "And then God put it into my heart to assemble the nobles and the officials." And we see that before. God's put something on Nehemiah's heart. Where before that was, yes, the walls. We see something like that in chapter 2. Now, work's not done. Work's not complete. And he acknowledges that. So now, what has Nehemiah got to do in Jerusalem? Why is Jerusalem special? How are the people there going to be reformed to be God's people again? How are they to live as God's people in God's place? We've just been singing that about God's people. And we read in those list of names, didn't we? There was a few names there about God's people. And that list that we have in this, basically, from verses, verse 6 to the end of the chapter, more or less, is more or less identical to Ezra chapter 2. So Ezra makes this genealogy there about who helps with the temple, who serves in the temple, and Nehemiah uses more or less the same list. There's a couple of numbers that are different. If you're wondering about that, speak to me later on. But Nehemiah used that list that was created. And Nehemiah has a few questions he has to face, which we'll hopefully answer now. There's the security of the walls. These walls have been built, but now they require these bodyguards, as it were. And who are going to be the leaders? We looked at leaders this morning in 2 Corinthians. Who are going to be the leaders in this community? And in verse 4, we see another problem that we see here. Verse 4, "The city was wide and large, but people within it were few, and no houses had been rebuilt." That's not to say there wasn't anyone living in Jerusalem. There were a few. But basically, there wasn't much life within the walls. One of the big things throughout the rest of the book is that what we're going to be looking at in future weeks is how do the people repopulate Jerusalem? And again, why is Jerusalem special? And that's the heart of the issue here in chapter 7, chapter 10, and chapter 11. And basically what we're seeing is in the city, we've got the temple, we've got the walls, but there's not much else. So there's three things that we're going to look at in this chapter now. And my three points create one sentence. So God's people, point one, in God's place, point two, with a glorious goal. So God's people in God's place with a glorious goal. So point one, you see, God's people. And firstly, we see God's people, don't we? We see a few God's people. We see names, lots of them. And before we get there, before we go on to looking at verse 6 and onwards, before we get there, we've mentioned that the walls are complete. We see that the doors are set in place, and that would have been the last thing that goes on. So when the doors are done, we're really done. Job done. So now Nehemiah has to sort out the security. He has to sort out the bouncers, basically, to these walls, around the walls. And who are you going to get, would you say, to look after these walls? These bouncers are now going to protect the work that you've done, but also protect God's people in God's place. So Nehemiah looks out among the people. Who would you choose for that job? Perhaps you'd choose bodybuilders. Perhaps you'd choose the ones who win the Dave Steer Award for Bravery. But actually, none of the above. Look down, verse 1. The gatekeepers, the singers, the Levites had been appointed. All of these people were from that priestly, like Levitical line. You might find that odd. The gatekeepers, the singers, the Levites. But these were the ones, we can look back kind of throughout the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, and see there that actually those people, the gatekeepers, the singers, the Levites, were usually the ones who were guarding the temple. But here they're guarding the walls, which here we can kind of see that actually the key to guarding the temple, the security of the temple, must be the security of the walls themselves. And as good Welshmen, we know that actually you can be rough, you can be tough, and still be a good singer. Just ask the Welsh coal miners and their choirs, they can tell you that. But that's the security. So you've got the gatekeepers, the singers, the Levites. The next thing we see is the leaders. And the next thing we read about God's people is the leaders. So verse 2, I gave my brother Hananiah and Hananiah, the governor of the castle, in charge of basically this Jerusalem area. So what would you look for in a leader? We looked at this morning, didn't we? We looked at the kind of the leadership race for Labour. They've just recently done that with our new Prime Minister as well. Perhaps you want to take a different course of action. If you want to go into Google Images and write great leaders, this is what's going to come up. You see Winston Churchill, he comes up. Steve Jobs, Queen Elizabeth, Gandhi, Barack Obama, Nelson Mandela, Bill Gates, and last but not least, Oprah. And I don't know what leadership qualities they have, but for God's people, in God's place, for us now, what leadership qualities do we want for our leaders? And verse 2 says that, doesn't it? If you look down, someone who is faithful and God-fearing. Faithful and God-fearing. The NIV uses a great word, integrity, the NIV uses. We want someone who's faithful, God-fearing, someone who has integrity. And what does that mean? What would this faithfulness look like? What does integrity mean? And well-known preacher Don Carson, he says that integrity means being in public what you are in private. Being in public what you are in private. Not being two-faced. Not being someone here and then being someone different at home. Being one person here and then being someone else at work tomorrow morning. Not being two-faced. And that's the one thing that you should want from your leaders and the characteristic you would want for yourself as being God's people. This faithfulness, this integrity. Our leaders must be those who are the same in public as they are in private. But why is Hananiah... Why is he chosen here? Why is he a man of integrity? Why is he a man of integrity? Because he feared God. he had integrity because he feared God. That doesn't mean we've looked at this in recent weeks. So it doesn't mean that he was cowering in fear from God, in terror from God. But it means remembering how God has treated us and living our lives in response to that. And that's it. The person who fears God is conscious that they are living their life before the same audience in both public and private. And that audience is God, because he sees both. He sees what you're like in the public. He sees what you're like in the private. He sees it all. And as God's people, as particularly leaders, we should have this quality. And what else do we see in the chapter? We see a lot of God's people here, don't we? In verses 7 to 38, we read about the laity. We read about the everyday people. It's great that they come first in, obviously, Ezra chapter 2 and here. And the laity, the everyday people, they were the ones that did the work in the temple. They're the ones that rebuilt the wall, and they come first here, which is great to see. But we whiz through them quite quickly, don't we, from verses 38. From the second part of verse 7 to 38. We whiz through them quite quickly. And then we get to verse 39, and we read here. In 39, we read about the priests. Then it goes on, verse 43, about the Levites. Verse 46, about the temple servants. Verse 57, the sons of Solomon's servants, who again worked in the temple. And we read there, verse 60, about all those temple servants. It's very much focused on what people did in and around the temple, which is not hugely surprising, considering it came from Ezra. But we read again about the Levites, the singers, and the gatekeepers who are listed amongst those temple people in God's people. But they're not the same people who are guarding the city walls. They're people guarding the city walls and the temple. All of these people that we read about from basically verse 39 all the way to 60 are people who, their lives revolved around the temple, in temple service. There's a lot of coverage given here about the temple. There surely is something for us to learn then about the temple. That's what Nehemiah is trying to focus us on. And that brings us to our second point. So we read about God's people. We've read about the security, we read about the leaders, we read about the laity, but now it kind of focuses towards, not that quote up yet, sorry, yeah, brilliant. So now it focuses towards God's place. So we've got God's people, point two, in God's place. And we've been reading about Jerusalem from the very beginning. In chapter one, we saw Nehemiah get, in verses one and two, we see him get really upset about the state of Jerusalem. But why is Jerusalem important? What's the fuss about Jerusalem? Why does it matter? Because Jerusalem is where the temple was. Okay, we've seen about these temple workers. What's the fuss about the temple? It's just a building. What's the fuss? Because that is where God dwelt with his people. And that's why more detail is given between verses 39 and 60 about those who worked in the temple. God's people being in God's place did matter. Because we're this side of the cross, we might say, well, God is everywhere. We don't need to limit him to the temple. Why then is the temple important? Because, we've got to ask them, what is the primary point to the temple in the Old Testament? Because in the temple, that is where sin was dealt with. That is where the people went with their sin. Nehemiah was concerned not just about the state of Jerusalem and the state of the people, but he was concerned about the state of their spiritual welfare. That's why he's concerned about the people standing before God. And he knew that sin had to be dealt with. So this is why it's focused around the temple here. We read about in, you know, places like Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and those places, we read about the law and how we live our lives in response to that, how we should live our life in what we should do, what we shouldn't do. But at the heart of all those laws given is what went on at the temple. is what went on at the temple. That's why Ezra was so concerned about rebuilding that temple. But for us now, why does it matter? You really need to go to the temple in Jerusalem. It's not there. Why does it matter? Why does it matter for us living this side of the cross? But now, because of Jesus, God lives among us as God's people. He now lives among us. Remember, we read this morning in that 2 Corinthians reading, for we are the temple of the living God. We are the temple of the living God. Jesus is the fulfillment of all these Old Testament texts. He's the fulfillment of all these Old Testament prophecies. So a Dutch reformer, he writes about this, called Herman Bavinck. He writes this. I've got a quote coming up. He writes this. There it is. So he writes about this, Jesus being the fulfillment. He says, the law and the prophets have been fulfilled, and in Christ as their end and goal reach their destiny. In him all things have been fulfilled. He, Jesus, is the true prophet, priest, and king, the true servant of the Lord, the true expiation, so cancellation of sin, the true sacrifice, the true circumcision, the true Passover, and therefore us. We are the true seed of Abraham. We are the true Israel. We are the true people of God. And we are the true temple of God. That's us. We are the temple of God. And I don't think we can just correctly estimate how amazing that is. We don't need to travel to the temple. We are the temple of God. Jesus is the fulfillment of everything that went on in the temple and in Jerusalem. Everything that it stood for. So we read some of those New Testament verses, didn't we, about that fulfillment. We saw in John chapter 1, the Word became flesh and tabernacled amongst us. The Word became flesh and Jesus dwelt amongst us. Nehemiah was so concerned for the spiritual welfare of God's people that it had to be done in God's place. It had to be done in Jerusalem. It had to be done in the temple. So now, are we concerned for God's people and God's place, which is now the church? Are you concerned about the church? Not just talking about this physical building. Are you concerned about each other? Are you concerned about the persecuted church? Our brothers and sisters on the other side of the planet who are suffering for their faith? Are you concerned about, this local church, not the building, but the people sitting next to you? And so often, being in the individual culture that we're in, we can so often celebrate and rejoice about God saving you. You can rejoice about God providing a way for you. You can rejoice, and you should be concerned about your personal life with God. Do you see as being part of the local church being vital in your Christian life? The early church, the apostolic church, they had an expression that said, there is no salvation outside of the church. What they're basically saying is, as soon as you become a Christian, you're in the church. And therefore, we must have concern for one another. As soon as you're saved, you're in the church. And sometimes, I don't think we do it here, but sometimes the worship songs that we sing about songs that go on about me, I, myself, those lyrics, rather than singing about us or our. And we can correctly say that Jesus died for me. Nothing wrong with that. But how incredible is it that Jesus died for us? And that's incredible. And that's why at the Lord's Supper, we drink the wine together, remembering that Christ died for us, his bride, his church. And therefore, we should be concerned about one another. God dwelt with his people then in the temple. But he couldn't be limited to that. God now dwells with his people, now through Christ. He dwells with his people in the church. And that's why in Revelation 21, we read this. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is now with man. He will dwell with them and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God." How awesome is that? God will dwell with them as their God. There's no temple in that new heaven and new earth, because the dwelling place of God is with his bride, his church. And that's an awesome future, isn't it? If you're believing in Christ, say that's your future. And that's a great vision. And as a church, we must always keep that vision in mind. No matter what circumstances we face now, we must have that vision in mind. But as a church, we must have a vision. We must have a goal for the future. And that brings us to our last point. God's people in God's place with a glorious goal. With a glorious goal. So we saw at the beginning in verse 4, we saw that the city was wide and large, but the people within it were few, and no houses had been rebuilt. So there wasn't much life inside the walls itself. Jerusalem, this what was meant to be a great city. You know, we see the David's day, Solomon's day, that great glorious city, a city that was meant to be a light to the Gentiles. Well, now it's got hardly anyone living in it. And if you flick to the end, you see in verse 73, towards the end of the verse there, it said about the temple servants and all of Israel lived in their towns. And at the very end of that, the people of Israel lived in their towns. The numbers here, if you add all of them up, I don't know if you're counting as Tim read it, the numbers here, as you add them up, it will go to around about 50,000 people. Around about 50,000 people. And to begin with, in our day, that's not a huge city, is it? But Nehemiah chapter 10 and 11 actually tells us an idea to try and the plan to repopulate the city of Jerusalem was actually out of these people they were going to take one out of every 10 people to live in Jerusalem and relocate there, which means it would be about 5,000 people in Jerusalem. I mean, it's not a lot, is it? I mean, it's far less than the half of the population of Newtown, and they call themselves a city. That's quite pathetic, isn't it? I don't know if you've heard about China's ghost cities. Again, Google Images, write that in when you go home. China's ghost cities. And during the time of recession, China spent billions and billions building these massive cities, from shopping centres to football stadiums to apartments, with no one living in them and no one working in them. Type it in later on. And it's thought that in China at the moment, with these cities, that there's round about 64 million empty houses in China. 64 million. That's the population of Britain. And the crazy thing is, they're still being built today. They're still building them today. So people are saying, what on earth are you doing, pouring money and resources into this? And one fairly reliable article I read, it wasn't from Wikipedia or anything, but one reliable article I read said that actually it looks like, with the growth at the moment in China, it looks like by the year 2030, a lot of these cities are going to be filled. They're planning for the future, they're looking ahead, and that's crazy, isn't it? But with Nehemiah and the people, despite the city's current size, despite just 5,000 people moving in there, they have this great vision for the city. They're building towards this glorious goal. They have this great vision, and we can tell that they believed in it. Why can we tell that they believed in it? Because they gave to the work. If you look down at verses 17 to 72, we read there about some of the heads of the fathers' houses gave to the work. We read about the other things being given there. They gave to the work. Their vision was matched by their giving. And even though the task ahead of them, to repopulate a whole city. Even though the task of ahead of them was immense, they believed this with their small efforts that God would build something amazing. And I got this quote from Tim, I hope he doesn't mind me, when he preached on this a few years back. He said this, that on this subject, the degree to which a church gives sacrificially to support the work goes a long way to determining whether they have a vision for the future. Do you remember that? Yeah, good. And many of us here, we've just been praying for the camps. Many of us here, we have a vision, we have this goal that we want to reach for Christ in these camps, for these camps, the work of the camps. We perhaps have a vision that we want to give towards the holiday club work that was going to go on this summer. Many of you gave and are still giving to the building work out the front. I mean, that's having a vision, yeah. But it's got to be more than that as well, hasn't it? We've got to be praying about this. And we must have a vision as well for our evangelism. We must have a vision for our evangelism. We must have a vision for our kids and our youth work. We must have a vision for our ladies' work. We must have a vision for our men's work. We must have a vision for our next Family Fun Day. I remember I heard this line when I went to a church in Cardiff, and it's always stuck with me. I'm talking about evangelism, having this need for this vision of evangelism. And they said this, a church that doesn't evangelize, a church that doesn't baptize, dies. A church that doesn't evangelize, a church that doesn't baptize, dies. And sadly, we've seen that too often in Wales and in Britain over recent years. They haven't had this vision. They haven't been doing evangelism. They haven't been getting people through the doors to baptize them. If you look down, flick over again, back to verse 5, and then God put it into my heart. God put it into my heart. He was doing this work for God. He believed in this vision. Hudson Taylor said that very famous line about mission work, didn't he? God's work, done in God's way, will never lack God's supplies. God's work, done in God's way, will never lack God's supply. But do we, as a church, do we have a vision for the future? Do we believe that if we're going to do God's work, if we're going to do it in God's way, then we're not going to lack God's supply? And I'll finish with this personal story about my mum and dad. I know I've used them in a few sermons, so forgive me for that. They were fairly influential in my upbringing, so forgive me for that. But as some of you know, my parents were involved in mission work in Central Asia, and that came to an end. And my mum, when we were in our local church in Kent, always used to take youth groups to bunkhouses in Wales for the October half term. And she always wanted to be able to provide that for other people. She'd seen youngsters come to Christ on those weeks away, weekends away, and she always wanted to provide that and had that goal, had that vision to be able to provide that for other people. So when they moved to Wales to start this work, they didn't have any money. They relied on gifts, they relied on grants, they told the builders, they told the bank when they set up the account that we don't have any income, we're relying on God to provide the funds. And as building work started, as grants came in, as gifts came in from godly individuals for this vision, as the building work started, sometimes building work started and they hadn't, you know, perhaps got the money to pay for the work that they were doing, but they relied on God to provide that. My builders, actually, Prince Charles has a house fairly nearby, and he had the same builders as my parents, so sometimes, if he needed work done, they had to quickly pack up and go to his. Apparently he had priority. But so, now and again, that was actually quite good news that I had to stop the work and go to Prince Charles's house because there's a bill due to be paid and they couldn't pay it. And My mum said quietly, she didn't broadcast it at all. My mum said quietly that, you know, she loves getting these gifts in and seeing how God's provided in the past. But she said about herself that often she felt like Israel, that she could see how good God has been in the past. And then she got worried about the future, about this next bill that needed to be paid. And she said quietly to the family, no one else, she said she thinks £40,000 would complete the project after some work had begun. She thought £40,000 would complete it. She didn't tell anyone, though. And bills were coming in. Bills were coming in. No money coming in. And it got to the point where it was like, maybe God's way doing this. Maybe he wants us to go to the bank to get a loan. My dad went to the bank, and you know, they told the builders that God would provide. They told the bank that God would provide this. And now my dad was going to the bank to ask for a loan. And as he was queuing up, he was wrestling with this in his mind. And he got to the kiosk there and he said, you know what? God's provided in the past. He'll do it again. Much to the confusion of the kiosk lady. He's like, right. A few days later, I was taking the dog for a walk and I went to go and get the post. My mum was out. As I got the post, thought nothing of it and gave the post to my dad. And he opened a letter, and it was from family friends in Kent. One was he was a gardener, and one was a carer, so they didn't have much money, and they were careful. But as he opened this letter, inside was a cheque for £40,000. And my mum's goal, my mum's vision of youngsters come to Christ has happened. It was absolutely amazing, and I will never forget my mum's reaction when we gave her that check. But God's work, done in God's way, will never lack God's supply. And we see in this chapter, God's people in God's place with a glorious goal, and now us sitting here, for us, because of Christ, because of our hope in him, we are God's people. We are God's place. And we still have a glorious goal. We face a task unfinished.